Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 72 and partly cloudy. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 50s. Then tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high in the low 90s. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the low 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Justin Moore. The small-town USA singer-songwriter recommends working at the beach, his mother's cooking, and staying home until age 30. By Wendy Wilkinson. Small-town guy Justin Moore first went to number one a decade ago with the song Small Town USA. Since then, he's hit the big time in a big way. Before going on the road with his Late Nights and Long Necks tour, scheduled to kick off January 16th in Dodge City, Kansas, and wrap up April 11th in Green Bay, Wisconsin, the Arkansas native talked with us about making the new album, leaving Nashville to move back home, and living on his family's land. Late Nights and Long Necks at the Beach. More so than any other place, I find inspiration at the beach. A lot of guys who live in Nashville, I was one of them for 10 years or so, would make an appointment at 10 o'clock and go to somebody's office and write. A lot of artists write on their buses, which I've done a number of times also. But I don't feel as creative in those environments as I do somewhere like the beach. 6 years ago or so, we bought a house down on the Florida Panhandle in the Destin area. We spend all summer down there, so it's a special place for my family. When I first moved to Nashville, my producer and I would just pop down there and rent a house and lock ourselves in, drink beer, write songs. A lot of those early album cuts and hit records we had, we wrote down there. As we were discussing what we were going to do on this album, I said, "Man, why don't we just go down to my house and do like we used to and grab a couple of our songwriter buddies and go lock ourselves in, drink beer, write songs." We're all married now and have kids, so I don't know how we slipped that one past our wives, but we did. And it was probably the most fun I've had making an album. Back home in Poyen, Arkansas. When I go home, outside of playing golf or hunting or fishing, my hobbies are either working on a tractor or doing something outside on our property. The land's been in our family since the late 1800s. My mom and dad live on it. My uncle and his family live on it. And a first cousin of mine lives on it along with us. When we moved back, we were looking for land, and it's kind of hard to come by in Poyen. So the idea was floated out there by my grandpa and my parents and aunts and uncles said, "Why don't you just buy this land and keep it in the family?" So that's what my wife and I tried to do, and it's been great. I'm not a big city guy, obviously, and I like having property where we can get out, ride four-wheelers or horses or whatever. Why he stays small town. It's home. When we were getting ready to graduate high school, I was the one guy who said, "Hey, man, I want to stay home and eat my mom's cooking until I'm 30. I don't want to go nowhere." And I'm the only one, of course, that ended up going somewhere. Nashville's been really good to me. I have great relationships and friends there still, and spend some time there now. But it was always my intention to move back home, because I grew up in a town of 300 people, and I'm very, very close to my family. I wanted to raise my kids the way I was raised. I wanted them to grow up where I grew up and go to church, and I wanted to attend church at home. When I get off the road, I'd rather be eating lunch at my mom and dad's house or my grandma's house than be 450 miles away. I'm still Justin there. Brody Kress. The Wyoming saddle bronc rider won a historic third consecutive Cheyenne Frontiers buckle by focusing on training, not results. By Matt Crossman. When Brody Kress started entering saddle bronc riding competitions, he got all amped up before every ride. His concentration was so intense, his focus on a good outcome so complete, that he would have no idea what happened on the ride once it was over. "It's all happening so quick," he says, "that when you're done, someone asks you what happened, you say, 'I don't know, I blacked out.' It takes so many horses just to get a feel for it, to get past that point of blacking out." Focusing on outcomes is a sure way to burn out in rodeo because there are too many variables outside of an athlete's control. The best riders focus instead on preparation, to be ready for whatever comes. And that's how Kress learned to deal with pre-ride anxiety. At the Cheyenne Frontier Days Rodeo in 2017, Kress showed he had moved beyond that beginner's phase and into a stage of his career when he could prove himself a superstar. Before a re-ride in the final round, pressure surrounded Kress, the hometown hero. The announcer didn't help. Speaking to a packed arena, he went on and on about Kress's accomplishments. "It would have absolutely sucked if I would have gotten bucked off in that situation," Kress says. Instead of succumbing to the chaos around him, Kress ignored it. He trusted his well-practiced pre-ride routine and his knowledge of the horse to carry him through. "If I didn't have set ways that I did things or didn't block stuff out and calm down for a situation like that," he says, "I guarantee I would have been bucked off." He stayed on the horse for a win that hinted at superstardom to come. Later in 2017, he entered the National Finals Rodeo in sixth place, rode all 10 horses, and vaulted to second in the world. In 2017, he won all three major rodeos, Cheyenne, Pendleton, and Salinas, and became the first Western athlete in any rodeo event to do so. He won Cheyenne Frontier Days again in 2018, the first rider to win the title back-to-back since the 1930s. Then, on July 28, 2019, Kress made history with an unprecedented third consecutive Cheyenne Frontier Days saddle bronc buckle. Disciplined preparation has taken him to great heights already. Now, as Kress works his way back from two broken bones that cut his 2018 season short and hampered the start of 2019, he'll need to focus more than ever on preparation if he wants to assume a spot among the elite of his sport. Kress grew up in a rodeo family in Wyoming. His dad rode bucking horses, and his mom was a rodeo queen whose family owned a ranch in Colorado. Still, Kress started off slow, learning the sport on horses that, he says, couldn't jump over a beer can. He was a three-time state wrestling champ in high school, and he sees parallels between that sport and riding saddle broncs. "When you step on that mat, you're relying on yourself," he says. "There's nobody else. It's the same thing in rodeo. There's so many ups and downs. It's a mental game. You've got to be gritty. You've got to be tough. You've got to find a way to push through stuff." Already in his young career, he has had to apply that lesson. He broke both bones in his lower right leg August 4, 2018, at a rodeo in North Dakota. A surgeon inserted three metal plates and more than two dozen screws. For rehab, Kress drove 3 hours round trip from Stephenville, Texas, where he starred on the Tarleton State University rodeo team, to work out at a facility in Decatur. His roommate, Jimmy DeLeon, was so impressed by Kress's work ethic that he soon joined him for the long drives and workouts. "Never once did he complain, and you could tell he was in a lot of pain," says DeLeon, a steer wrestler. It just shows his mindset of wanting it. Kresk guesses he was about 75% healthy for the 2018 NFR, and his poor results show it. Still, he doesn't regret competing, even if he wasn't ready. Everybody dreams of competing at that level, he says. I'm sure there are hundreds of people who just wish they could be bucked off in that arena every night. They never got the opportunity to do anything but sit in the stands and watch it. Kress carries himself with a curious mix of bravado and humility, a blend that saddlebronc riding almost demands for survival. Kress wants to win every rodeo he enters. He also says it would take forever to thank everyone who has helped him get to this point. He has uncommon maturity for a 24-year-old. De Leon calls him often from the road to ask for advice and break down recent performances. Says De Leon, "He's asking me, 'How'd your run go?' I said, 'Man, not good. I did this and this and this wrong.' He said, 'It takes time. In rodeo, there's going to be a lot more down than up. You have to roll with it. When the times are high, you need to take advantage of it. Soak it in. When times are low, that's when you really got to dig deep and keep working at it.'" Kress learned that the hard way. He struggled to start the 2019 season, as his leg still wasn't 100%. By mid-June, he felt like he had returned to full strength, though he still wasn't sprinting or jumping yet. His recovery allowed him to restart his journey to join the best in the sport. He stormed back from a low spot in mid-season rankings to qualify for NFR, the results of which came after press time. Like preparing for a rodeo, the key to a successful comeback for him is to focus on the process rather than the results of any individual competition. "You don't want to think too far ahead," he says. "More important than that, I've got to think about the steps right now, what I'm doing day to day." Charged. What was supposed to be a normal day in the woods changed the course of Montana chef and outdoorsman Eduardo Garcia's life in the most shocking way. By Jason Cohen. Photography by Becca Skinner. Eduardo Garcia can chop an onion faster, better, and more uniformly than you or I. With one hand. The fact that he cooks with a prosthetic where his left hand and 10 inches of his left forearm used to be, makes his mad kitchen skills all the more impressive. "I got a lot more rustic," Garcia, a trained professional chef, outdoorsman, and occasional triathlete, says of his post-accident cooking style. He had to adapt, a lot, after the freak backcountry electrocution in 2011, that nearly took his life, and then changed the course of it. Garcia, a trim 38-year-old with bright hazel eyes and thick dark hair, is making breakfast in his home kitchen in a Montana community not far from Bozeman. His wife, Becca Skinner, is getting a few photos. His pit bull collie mix, Veda, is flopped on the kitchen floor. It's a relaxed vibe. Lopping off the stem and root ends of a red onion, he peels and starts to slice. "I'm not so worried about everything being the same size or not." During the time when he couldn't cook at all, after 21 surgeries and several years of rehab, Garcia lost his knife callus, the toughened-up nub you get from holding a chef's most essential tool, in the same spot for hours and hours every day. Now, instead of the usual 10-inch chef's knife workhorse, his implement of choice is an 8-inch Japanese shun blade, a gift from a friend. "It was a lot of weight to hold, to not have a hand guiding it anymore," he says. "I haven't gone back." It's a typically perfect winter day in Big Sky Country, clear and cold and sunny. Garcia's community has a view of the mountain landscape that eventually becomes the Big Sky Ski Resort in Yellowstone National Park, with all the fly fishing, hiking, and hunting you could want just miles away. Plus, room enough for a 1/3-acre garden and multiple off-road-worthy vehicles. Garcia's house is the creative and functional heart of his food business, Montana Mex, which sells a line of sauces, barbecue, ketchup, habanero, seasonings, jalapeno, mild chili, sweet, and avocado oil. It's his personal kitchen and his test kitchen, a custom add-on with a wood-fired oven, a 6-burner range, a commercial hood, and picture windows that frame the occasional bald eagle soaring by. Before he built this space, the smoke alarm went off all the time while he was cooking, just like it does for the rest of us. Unlike the rest of us, Garcia's onion slices are pretty much perfect. Minced garlic comes next, followed by a bunch of lucernado kale, which he expertly and easily destems and swoops to one side of the cutting board, not with a knife or bench scraper, but with the metal tool that's attached to his prosthetic left arm. In the documentary film about Garcia's life, Charged, he can be seen using the grippy 2-pronged hook as an avocado masher, making guacamole for Montana Mex. Now, as he moves those kale leaves around, gesticulating and talking with his hands, the prosthetic seems almost natural, like another arm. You just don't want to accidentally bump into what is basically a block of steel and carbon on a city street. I'll go, "Oh, I'm sorry," Garcia says, and then I'll look at them and they're like, "Did I just hit a wall?" You'd never know that Garcia's hair hides scars from burn wounds, and that it all fell out, not because of the electrocution, but from chemotherapy for testicular cancer that was discovered while he was in the middle of those 21 surgeries. Nor would you guess that underneath the blue flannel Patagonia shirt, some parts of this compact and athletic man simply aren't there. In some ways, the amputation was the least of it. "I'm still missing ribs," Garcia says. "I'm still missing huge chunks of muscles in my body." On October 9th, 2011, Eduardo Garcia poked the bear. In this case, the bear was dead, but still unexpectedly dangerous. It should have been a normal day for a kid who grew up in Montana. It was a typical day bow hunting, Garcia says. Park the truck, head into the national forest, go look for elk. It wasn't an epic no-cell-phone, backcountry type of adventure. Just going for a walk in the woods with my bow, trying to fill the freezer. I'd just never been in that drainage or seen that can before. That can, a rusty barrel sitting in the middle of nowhere. Inside, the remains of a bear cub. Garcia took out his knife, thinking that a claw might make for a good souvenir or piece of jewelry. Then the same 2,400 volts that had been the bear cub's death blow hit Garcia. That barrel was supposed to be covering up an old mining cabin's electrical line. It was live and unmaintained. Covered in third-degree burns, he somehow managed to stay upright. He hiked out on a road, a longer distance, but Garcia knew that if he fell on less reliable terrain, he'd probably never get back up or live. Eventually, he made it to where there were vacation homes and got help. He was rushed to an ER in Livingston, Montana, then medevaced to the University of Utah Burn Unit in Salt Lake City. The force of the voltage passing through his body was such that he had 9 exit wounds. The incident took place just 2-3, as the crow flies, miles from where I grew up, Garcia says. that was Emigrant, Montana, south of Livingston, east of Bozeman, and north of Yellowstone. The outdoors was his babysitter and his backyard, with horned owls and coyotes for neighbors. Garcia's mother, Kathy, is actually a New Yorker of Jewish-Russian descent who had wandered off to Mexico, where she first met Eduardo's father, Manuel, a fisherman, and then California. Eduardo and his twin brother, Eugenio, were born in Van Nuys. She was also a member of something called the Church Universal and Triumphant, which bought up land around Yellowstone and relocated to Montana. To outsiders, the church was either a commune or a cult. Its leader, Elizabeth Clare Prophet, had predicted the world would end in 1990, possibly from nuclear war. Fortunately, when it didn't, there was no Jim Jones or Waco-like follow-up. When Eduardo first left the church's self-contained community, which included everything from a chicken farm to hot springs, to attend public school, he remembers the other kids thought it was weird that they ate soy sauce and miso soup and organic foods. In other words, Californians. As Charged recounts, Garcia was a hard-partying teen who decided to get straight and high on life. The outdoors inspired him. It was spiritual, transformative. There's some kind of energy vibration I feel when I'm out in the woods watching an eagle fly or watching deer walk their way through a field, he says. Cooking also inspired him. He started at 15 in the bar and grill at Montana's iconic Chico Hot Springs and has been in the kitchen ever since. There is a general kind of adrenaline rush, he says. You're cooking over live fire. There's hot things. There's metal. There's sharp tools. You're multitasking. People are shouting. Your pulse is quickened. And then the end result of what you're doing is potentially, hopefully, a smile or a satisfaction. You're bringing joy and pleasure to another human being. That's probably a more articulate version of what I would have thought at 15, which was like, this is rad. Garcia could have easily become a fishing guide or forest ranger, a Montanan living the outdoorsman's dream. But having grown up with a father who had left his three children behind to go back to Mexico and fish, Garcia did not meet his dad until he was 13. He went for the more traditional path, culinary school. He worked two jobs in Seattle to cover his tuition, one of which was as a model for a bronze sculptor. And after graduation, instead of getting stuck on the line at a hotel or country club, he scored a gig on a 107-foot yacht that took him from British Columbia to Costa Rica and all ports in between. The crew was at the behest of the boat owners and their guests, but with a lot of unsupervised time. When no one else was on the boat, there were opportunities for culinary experimentation and plenty of outdoor adventure. It was on the yacht that Garcia met his English ex-girlfriend and Montana Mex business partner, Jennifer Jane. By 2007, they were back in the Livingston-Bozeman area, and 3 years later they started what was basically a family business, including Garcia's sister and twin brother, taking fresh salsas and guacamole to farmers' markets and local grocery stores. And then, suddenly, the whole business was in ICU with me holding my hand, Garcia says. Somewhat incredibly, the ICU became a film set. Charged is full of footage of Garcia before the accident and during his recovery. It opens on day 8, his head shaved, black with burns. He is fully conscious. During the previous 7 days, nobody really knew if he was going to live. Before the accident, in addition to Montana Mex, Garcia and Jane had been pitching a TV food show focused on his cooking and his passion for the Montana outdoors, making the rounds of networks and Hollywood agents with a sizzle reel. The Food Network was interested, which is why they had all kinds of footage of Garcia. Jane and director Philip Barbeau decided to keep filming, a move that in retrospect seems almost a bit too savvy. It was also more profound than that. Making the movie became part of Garcia's rehab. It was an act of faith for everyone that there would be a movie to finish and it wouldn't be a eulogy. A lot of that had to do with, "I just didn't realize the gravity of my situation," Garcia says. "I didn't realize how severe this was. Being in ICU and being wrapped in gauze and bandaged head to toe, I still wanted to have a purpose. I still wanted to have some autonomy. I still wanted to know that I had value." It's hard to see yourself as a chef anymore when you've lost a hand and you're told you have cancer and you're wrapped up head to toe. That superseded any inkling of, "Oh, don't film this. I look like or boo-hoo." The journey of the film finds him bonding further with his father, who died in 2017, getting involved with the Challenged Athletes Foundation as a triathlete, and eventually becoming a motivational speaker. Another handicapped triathlete urged Garcia to let go of his shame and modesty, to not be embarrassed by his prosthetic, to not be ashamed that he had lost a testicle. He could embrace those things and still be the same cool, confident, handsome, chefy, outdoorsy dude he was before. "It's a very scary thing to show your weakness," Garcia says, "but to own who you are and share your truth is the first step in accessing your true strength." His ICU doctor in Utah also gave him a bit of a come-to-Jesus pep talk, pointing out that so many people come through his burn unit, let alone have cancer or lose a limb, don't come out of it nearly as well as Garcia did. He looked at me and he was like, "Dude, your hair grew back. Your scars are nice and flat. You're running and jumping. You're largely you again. And you're kicking ass. You have a responsibility to share what recovery can be with others. Tell your story, Ed." When Garcia was first recovering from the accident, People magazine ran a story calling him the bionic chef, which made him cringe. You can't really blame him for using that as part of his branding, especially when his story inspires others. You could just be like, "Hey, don't profile me as an amputee," Garcia says. But no way. You have to use what you have. It's been 7 years since the last surgery, and Garcia continues to live with PTSD. At this point, the recovery is more mental than physical. "Now I'm working on the psychological parts," Garcia says. "Just forgiving." I naturally said the word forgiveness. "What do I have to forgive myself for?" "I don't know, but I just said it. I shed many tears over the years. It was a very traumatic thing to nearly die. But I sure as she don't need to carry the weight of what happened with me every day." Montana Mex is now a national food business. With encouragement from Jane, Garcia got back into the TV show the two of them imagined 10 years ago, reimagined and scaled down, as a series of internet-friendly short films funded by Yeti. The hungry life finds him fishing, hunting, and hiking with various personalities while also cooking outdoors. Back in Garcia's home kitchen, the kale and onions have sautéed. They'll be accompanied by huevos rancheros. These days, the pleasures of cooking are simpler. It's about reminding himself he's a chef and also why he became one. Not for the buzz or the adrenaline, but the story and the experience. Sustenance. Camaraderie. He's doing more foraging, getting back into hunting, and has also taken up gardening. eating garlic that he put in and took out of the ground means something to him. He is also utilizing some of his Montana Mex products in the process. The avocado oil, which Garcia loves for its combination of good nutrition and high smoke point, the jalapeno and chili seasoning, and the habanero salsa over the eggs, which he fries four at a time in a cast iron pan. I wake up every day just fired up, Garcia says. I don't think, oh, I'm an amputee, my life sucks. I think, I'm Eduardo Garcia. I own a company called Montana Mex. I'm married to this babe in the next room. I've got a snoring dog. That sustained high I was looking for as a teenager, it's right here, right now. It's never, oh, another day. Anything past the here and now is just a bonus. A Pinto Milestone by Lindsay Weckel. Enter through the doors of any Pinto Ranch store, and the scent of fine leather will immediately overtake your senses. Your eyes will quickly catch up to your nose in awe of an impressive wall lined with handmade boots and fashion pieces. Cap this off with a friendly greeting by a knowledgeable sales associate, and you're on your way to experiencing what this 15-year-old Western business endeavors to embody: the grandeur, quality, and kindness of the American West. Pinto Ranch began as a vision of Walter Pye, Jr., a man whose retail roots run deep. From 1934 to 1997, his eponymous family retail shop was long associated with fine attire. But it was Pinto Ranch that brought Pye back onto the fashion scene. In 2004, Pinto Ranch opened its 13,000-square-foot flagship store in Houston. Named after a real working ranch in Wyoming, the store has since expanded to locations in Dallas and Las Vegas, as well as an airport location in Houston. It's an idea of the traditions and the legacy of the West, the pioneering spirit, that American style that is all our own, says B. Garcia, Pinto Ranch marketing director, of the inspiration behind the store. Inside its walls, visitors will find a vast but carefully curated collection of goods. From handmade boots, 14-karat gold buckles, finely crafted silver jewelry, one-of-a-kind saddles, and high-fashion apparel that blends ranch with runway. Here, the Western world is your oyster. The store offers an unexpected shopping experience to customers who might expect something more stereotypical, Garcia says. At Pinto Ranch, it is about pairing high-end apparel with authentic statement pieces for the Western lifestyle, and the modern-day trend of Western influences, found anywhere from Hollywood to New York City, inspires the business. People are blending fashions more, Garcia says. It's not such a vertical, strict styling that it used to be. We offer unique stylings that can fit with anything because it's truly American. I think people are open to doing something new and being individual in their fashion, which is nice because this means that we can continue to grow and expand what we have to offer, and that people will find us just as interesting and unique as they want to be. Customers can also revel in Pinto Ranch's brick-and-mortar locations. We love having visitors, Garcia says. Houston, Las Vegas, and Dallas couldn't represent us better than they do, because they're just iconic cities of the West. It's a great trio of representation for us, and we hope to move forward in those cities forever and be accessible to our customers. Part of being accessible means Pinto Ranch has embraced the online retail atmosphere with its trademark focus on customer service. Never fear, long-distance shoppers. Pinto Ranch prioritizes providing customers with the knowledge of sales associates who have decades-long histories in Western fashion. And if a customer needs to exchange a pair of boots, the brand is quick to offer free shipping until the buyer finds the perfect fit. Speaking of boots, Pinto Ranch prides itself on offering one of the largest selections of traditionally handmade boots in the country. This fall, Garcia says, they've outdone themselves. Our boots are the tried and true way of making boots that dates back over 150 years. So that's definitely a legacy that we're proud to continue. We're so excited about the boots in this fall and winter. Our boot buyer, Mike Burchette, has really done an outstanding job. You're not going to get a better boot anywhere. The Dynamic Duo. Brooks and Dunn are still humble after all these years. By Allison Bonaguro. So far, this year's been one for the books for Brooks and Dunn. In April, they released their first album together in 12 years. In March, they were inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame. And in August, that Hall of Fame and Museum opened a Brooks and Dunn exhibit to celebrate their nearly 30-year reign as country music's best-selling duo. It's the kind of feat Kix Brooks and Ronnie Dunn never saw coming. One of the duo's first hits from the early 1990s, Boot Scootin' Boogie, inspired by the Tulsa City Limits nightclub, paints a picture of guys who hit the door running when it's quitting time. But if you ask Brooks or Dunn, there's no such thing as quitting time. Right after their Hall of Fame induction ceremony, Brooks and Dunn sat down with Cowboys and Indians in a dressing room right outside the revered rotunda to talk about the series of events that brought them here. It comes down to their cowboy work ethic. Take a deep seat, a short rein, and get after it. For example, when Brooks and Dunn took home the Academy of Country Music's award for Entertainer of the Year in 1996, they were the first duo to do so in the history of the grand prize. You'd think that would give them some bragging rights. Our reaction to that win was, "Damn, we did that." We were shell-shocked. It hit us so hard that we really didn't have a clue. In fact, after we got up there and mumbled some thanks, we both walked off the stage in different directions, Dunn tells CNI. They were ill-prepared on purpose, Brooks adds. It always seems awkward to me when someone pulls a piece of paper out of their pocket. Even if you think there's an outside chance of a win, that you'd be that prepared, he says, laughing. We never even discussed winning, much less who we'd even thank. That always seemed too presumptuous. Like, why us? The two men have clung tight to that humble mindset ever since. Cowboys and Indians. So you truly had no expectations going into that 1996 ACM award show, even though you had amassed so many hits since your debut album in 1991? Ronnie Dunn. No, because it was all so new, and it all happened so fast. We weren't expecting any of that. The same week we met, we wrote two songs, and next thing we know, we thought we were just seat fillers at the ACMs, and then we won. This didn't make any sense, and it still doesn't. But eventually, you must have felt like you had earned the good things that were coming your way. Kix Brooks. We never trusted our success. We'd been kicking around doing solo deals for so long. Then at 36 and 38 years old, we were put together. To think we'd have a 25-year career in front of us, we'd both been in the business long enough to know that S-blank doesn't happen. But then our first single, Brand New Man, was such a success, we were like, well, that was weird. So you assumed it was some kind of country music fluke? Yes, and even though we knew we'd obviously make another record, we knew that ain't going to happen again. But then song after single and single after song, things just kept going. Both of us were always thinking it was about to be over. I remember talking with my wife when we first moved to Nashville about our financial goal. And if the dream came true and we hit a certain amount, then we were going to go back to Oklahoma. We were just here to get what we came for, knowing it doesn't last. And yet, it's been 23 years since that validation from the ACM. Now do you feel established? Maybe, but only because I never had a plan B. Meaning, regardless of the fame and riches, being a country music singer was the only plan you had? Yes, even when that meant living through some sheer poverty. I slept on a buddy's floor for a year and a half when I moved to Tulsa, after I'd dropped out of college. Back then, you'd hustle to get club owners to let you play. I had no goal other than just scraping up anything I could get. Same here. I had no money. I could always make some beer money playing in some bar in New Orleans, but once I decided to move to Nashville, it was the only place I'd been where I couldn't make a living making music. I was playing at the Bluebird Cafe for nothing. And me and David Lee Murphy would play at the Springwater Supper Club, a little beer joint, for $30 a night. My wife and I lived off the money we saved in a coffee can. But eventually, the money started rolling in. What did you do with all of it initially? Nothing, really, because at the time we had a manager we called Captain Downside. He had all those horror stories about artists who had hits and spent all their money. So we were careful not to spend money, and we stayed way under the radar on that. But I remember one of the first indulgences I had was when I bought a used, ugly, gray diesel Mercedes-Benz. Then I was too embarrassed to drive around town in a Mercedes-Benz, so I sold it. So if you weren't in it for the money, what were you earning in those early years? I had so much big fun when I got to Nashville, I didn't have blank for money. But I was partying all the time, just staying up to our necks in trouble. At 5 every day, you'd meet at publishing houses and play whatever half-assed piece of blank song you'd written that day. Then the greats would play what they'd wrote that day, and your eyes would roll back in your head, and you'd go, "I've got to work harder." I didn't respect Nashville songwriters until I got here. Those guys were like Hemingway. They'd break your heart if you'd give them a chance. So I have no regrets. I look back on all those times fondly. The Reboot album you released in April has 12 of your biggest songs recorded as duets with the newest singers from this modern era of country. Casey Musgraves, John Pardee, Thomas Rhett, Cody Johnson, Kane Brown, and more. Your music was a heavy influence on those artists. But who influenced you? Who were your Brooks and Dunn? Merle Haggard, George Jones, and then later, the Eagles. Brooks. Johnny Cash, Roger Miller, and Hank Williams especially. That was just as cool as it got. I was also a huge fan of Jerry Jeff Walker, Leon Russell, and Asleep at the Wheel. And, of course, the Eagles. Song after song. Good grief. Another coveted honor for you this year was when your Hall of Fame exhibit opened. What was it like to go down your own personal memory lane to collect all that B&D memorabilia? Done. I feel much more humble now that they came and took all my stuff out of my house. Brooks. I used to walk through my house, see all my awards, and be so proud of myself. But now, it's just like a regular house. We had to give it away, though, because you just can't hang 20 years of career in your house. There's not room in any house for all of it. Was the Hall of Fame induction something you saw coming, like a benchmark you deserved after nearly 3 decades as a duo? Done. Not at all. We're still in a state of disbelief. The best way to stay out of that head game is not to expect it and keep your mind on other things. If you want it all, the only way to get it all is to take one step at a time. Brooks. you can't ever think it's about time. All I ever hoped for was to wake up tomorrow and write a good song. This kind of thing may be in the back of your mind, but if money and the Hall of Fame are your goals, I don't see how you ever achieve anything. You need to take small steps. Find out more about the exhibit Brooks and Dunn, Kings of Neon, by visiting countrymusichalloffame.org. The Baritone Breakout. Kane Brown endured early struggles, but found massive success. When Kane Brown was growing up, all he wanted to do was fit in. Now, all he wants to do is stand out. And maybe that's why everything he's doing in country music right now is working out so well. Because even at just 25, Brown knows where he stands. Brown tells Cowboys and Indians about his unlikely path to Nashville and into the studio with Brooks and Dunn. Long before he was a bona fide country star, Brown was immersed in the music because of his mom. It was like an escape for me and my mom. We had a lot of pressure on us, and it was a bond for us, Brown says. My bedtime stories would be me and my mom singing together. Shania Twain, Sugarland, the Dixie Chicks. That music's been in my life ever since. During those early years, back when bullying was often overlooked, Brown suffered through countless taunts about how different he was. All the kids had money, and we didn't, he recalls. I had Old Navy clothes that didn't really fit, and the only football cleats we could afford were three sizes too big, so I was tripping over them all the time. I didn't fit in at all. Eventually, he outgrew that reputation, but by then, it was almost too late to learn to socialize. I wasn't used to talking to people. I stuck to myself. I was kind of weird. I used to always want to fit in, but now it's like I want to be an outcast. I want to stand out. I want to create my own lane. What Brown did with his alone time is where his lane began. He started singing well-loved country songs for homemade iPhone Facebook videos and quickly amassed a loyal following. So he made more and more. Eventually, he turned his social media fame into the real-life kind when he released his Closer EP, and it climbed all the country charts almost 2 years before he even signed his record deal. And somewhere between his major label self-titled debut album and his follow-up, Experiment, Brooks and Dunn discovered Brown and asked him to be a part of Reboot. Brooks and Dunn's ballad Believe came out in 2005 when Brown was only 12. But it was his grandfather's favorite song, so he knew it well. When he passed away, I'd listen to that song and I'd always tear up, he says. But still, when I asked if I could pick that song, everybody was a little bit nervous. We did it together in the studio, so that was super terrifying. It was the first time I'd ever met Ronnie Dunn, and then I was singing across from him in a studio. But he just coached me through it. I mean, he's got one of the best voices in country music, ever. That really broke me out of my shell. On the new version of the song, Brown's and Dunn's rich baritone voices are so similar that it's hard to hear where one stops and the other begins. But beyond the vocal tour de force, what Brown loves about Believe is exactly what he loves about that whole era of country, the storytelling. It was just unreal, Brown says. Like Craig Morgan's Almost Home, Randy Travis's Three Wooden Crosses. Those songs have to take months to write because you really are writing a story. I've always wanted to write a song like that. Like when it hits you, it really hits you. Hear Kane Brown's latest single, Like a Rodeo, and find out where to see him live by visiting lanebrownmusic.com. The next big names. Listen to these 8 up-and-comers for a sampling of country's future. You can't walk down one block of Nashville's honky-tonk row without being blown away by the talent. On any given day, it feels like Music City is bursting at the seams with way above average songwriters, musicians, and singers. And eventually, the best of the best of those hopefuls up and down Lower Broadway make it out of the bars and onto the radio. If there was a demographic cohort for that elite group, these country artists would be the ones defining the next generation. Jordan Davis. You can make assumptions about Jordan Davis for the first time you hear his music. His modern countryish songwriting leans a little pop, but don't let that fool you. The Louisiana-born newcomer has deep country roots and a vast array of influences from all of the much-heralded 90s country artists. So while he can turn up the freshly infectious groove in songs like his debut Singles You Up and Take It From Me, he can also sing you an old Shenandoah song on the spot or give you a long list of reasons why Jim Croce was the poetic lyricist he was. Riley Green. When Nashville welcomed Riley Green from Alabama, he could have easily been just another guy with a guitar ready to sing about his small town, his southern roots, and all the other cliches that modern country regularly relies on. But then, there was this girl. The vocals on his first big hit have just enough twang to take you back to a time when country was still very, very country. So yes, he's singing about a girl in his life, at his gig, and eventually by his side for life. But it's the way Green is doing it, so naturally and seamlessly, that makes him sound so genuine. Ryan Hurd. Writing country songs for other country artists is one of the ways that hopefuls get their foot in Nashville's door. That was the case for Michigan native Ryan Hurd, who penned tunes for just about every big act, Blake Shelton, Luke Bryan, Dierks Bentley, Tim McGraw, Jake Owen, Rascal Flatts, and on and on. His lyrics can be hopelessly romantic, quietly edgy, effortlessly sexy as hell, or all of the above. And now, finally, Hurd is the one on the radio singing the lyrics he penned. His latest hit, To a T, gives you a glimpse of the soulful and sultry side of his mind. Randall King. For most of the summer of 2019, Randall King was playing the road from his home state of Texas to Oklahoma and Wyoming. It's his proving ground before he sets off for the bar and club circuit all over the Midwest. But wherever King goes, he's bringing his West Texas roots with him. That will serve him well as he introduces crowds to his unambiguous art, full of steel guitar and substantive songwriting. King may have been influenced by the traditional artists who came before him, but soon he's going to be doing his part to keep the chain of influence going strong. Ashley McBride. The first time anyone outside of Nashville heard of Ashley McBride was right around the time her A Little Dive Bar in Dahlonega ended up on the radio, which was, as her follow-up song says, not bad for a girl going nowhere. Growing up in Arkansas with folks who weren't convinced she'd succeed as a country singer was fuel for her girl going nowhere. But after a few long years of playing open mic nights, people started to pay attention. And when Eric Church started paying attention, so did record labels, country radio, and brand new diehard fans of her So Honest They Hurt stories. Oh, and that Georgia haunt depicted in A Little Dive Bar is real. It's called The Crimson Moon. Matt Stell. The other Arkansas native on our list who almost didn't make the move to Nashville to be a country star at all. He had an alternate dream. one where it had been Matt Stell, M.D. But right before he was about to leave for a pre-med graduate program, he decided to give Nashville a shot. It was the right call. Ever since he chose to put his smarts to work in songwriting sessions, the outcome has been healthy, with tunes like the classically faith-based country Prayed for You and the outrunning a memory Everywhere But On, both getting big love on the radio and at his live shows. Tennille Towns. When Tennille Towns was 19, she went on a 45-hour road trip. She drove from her small town in Alberta, Canada, to Nashville, fueled by a youthful determination and a healthy obsession with lyrics. And somewhere in those 45 hours, Towns had a lot of time to think and to be inspired by the idea that everybody has a story. And maybe to look out the window, see a homeless woman, and realize that she wasn't always homeless. She was somebody's daughter. It's as if Towns has made it her mission to put the stories, the real ones, with a beginning, a middle, and an end, back into country songs. Haley Witters. When Haley Witters moved from Iowa to Nashville to chase her neon rainbow, she gave herself 10 years. That's supposedly the amount of time it takes to make it in country music. But right around the time when Witters moved past the 10th year and stayed, things started looking up for her as a songwriter. And like the most insightful songwriters do, she turned that impatience is a virtue mindset into one of her most honest tunes, 10-Year Town. It's just one of so many songs Witters has written that remind you what solid songwriting is supposed to sound like. She does the same with Heartland, turning a double entendre into pure poetry. It's a lost art, but Witters is on the verge of bringing the craftsmanship of country music back. Hear a playlist of these up-and-coming artists by visiting cowboysandindians.com and searching Next Big Names.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas. Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Noon Book Hour, followed by Music and Memories at 1.
Coronavirus Briefs. Because of the updated guidelines set by the CDC over the weekend, Odessa Arts Executive Director Randy Hamm said the following actions will be taken. Odessa Arts Office will be closed until April 1st. The Black and White Ball will be postponed until the fall. Tickets and tables already purchased will be honored at the yet-to-be-determined date. For refunds on tables, tickets purchased for the Black and White Ball or Literary Death Match, email judith@odessaarts.org. Books in Basin is canceled. April board meeting is canceled. All Arts Advocacy Month activities will be suspended, including visit from Randy Cohen from Americans for the Arts, and Community Art Gallery intake will be postponed until no earlier than May 15th.
Cut your grocery bill by listening to Recording Library of West Texas Radio's grocery store ads each week. Hear smart deals from HEB and Albertsons, as well as Supermercado Circular, whose prices are also good for affiliated food stores like Fiesta Foods in Midland, Lowe's in Odessa, Fisher's Food Mart in San Angelo, and all Thriftway and Allsup's locations throughout West Texas. Catch the ads on Recording Library of West Texas Radio Wednesday afternoons at 5 and Thursday mornings at 5. You can also download the ads by going to our website at recordinglibrary.org and clicking on the podcast page, or hear them 24 hours a day on the telephone reader by calling 617-5555. The Grocery Store Ads, read each week by volunteers at the Recording Library of West Texas. Read by listening.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 78.